Today on Wings, Games Nations Play.
The North protects its own producers and limits market access.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
From the Wings Archives, development economist Marilyn Waring explains how richer nations game their development and trade commitments. Liz Van Berkel is the producer and host.
Marilyn Waring is the author of If Women Counted. In 1995, the National Film Board of Canada made a documentary about her called Who's Counting? Sex, Lies, and Global Economics. At age 22, she was the youngest elected government representative in New Zealand. Now she is a professor. She was in Canada in June 2005 for an international conference on gross national happiness. The conference was held just prior to the G8 summit in Scotland and the Live 8 rock concerts, including one in Canada in Barrie, Ontario.
I left New Zealand on June the 19th. And since then, about 250,000 people have died of poverty, and the face of most of those people was female. In a week, the numbers who have died in poverty are more than equal to those that died in the Boxing Day tsunami. The ratio of fatalities gives a very clear account of the differences between the lives of men and women. Where were those women in the tsunami? They were in really different places from men. And they had the children to carry or to tend to. And they were encumbered and restricted by dress codes, which mostly make it more difficult to run. And even if they could drive motorcycles and cars, they wouldn't have been the adult with the keys to them. And no one's ever taught them how to swim. I've seen these reports only in the communication from feminist non-governmental organisations in the region, very rarely anywhere else. I've been asked to talk to you about caring for the people and the planet and the politics of development. And I want to talk to you about the biggest game in town for the next 10 years in terms of development assistance and the part we all have to play in that. They're called the Millennium Development Goals. It's the big thing this G8 summit is all about. And if you are thinking of going to Barrie, Ontario, the site of the Canadian G8 concert, I want to talk to you about the package that we, as citizens of New Zealand and Canada, are agreeing to if we physically, spiritually, or mentally want to go to Barrie. So we'll start with what are the Millennium Development Goals. Well, they were decided by most of the world's leaders at a UN conference at the turn of the century. In their smallest versions, won't surprise you, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality and empower women, reduce child mortality, improve maternal health, combat HIV/AIDS, malaria and other diseases, ensure environmental sustainability, and develop a global partnership for development. Well, if you listen to Mr. Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University, who has basically been the author of the reports around the Millennium Development Goals, you might think that there was something new about these. But even in my lifetime, they're just the new version. They follow the United Nations Development Decade, the North-South Dialogue. And Canada has an historic activity in respect of these because the Pearson Commission, led by Lester Pearson, developed the 0.7% of gross national income as the amount that donor countries should contribute or should aim at in respect of official development assistance, ODA, official development assistance. Okay. In the last 35 years, since that development decade, the world has spent $2.3 trillion on ODA, and not with great success. So it's got to be different this time. The next major activity is debt forgiveness. Now, the current total debt that we're talking about is $295 billion. There's 32 major indebted countries, 25 of them are in Africa. The donor countries have targeted 14 of the most indebted countries as a start for debt forgiveness, $40 billion, right? So now we've got Millennium Development Goals, we've got debt forgiveness as part of the package. Next, the Millennium Development Goals call for the elimination of tariff and trade barriers and quota-free trade access for what we call the least developed countries. This means no form of protection against imports from the most impoverished countries of the South. Now, a major ingredient of the North-South imbalance in poverty levels are the protectionist barriers that are erected by the European Union countries, the United States of America, Japan, and Canada to limit access for market goods from the South. This is the great hypocrisy of the World Trade Organization and the so-called free trade agenda, that those who are pushing it the strongest, imposing it the most on the countries of the South are those who, through quotas, subsidies and tariff barriers and a variety of other implements, some which are completely fabricated and manipulated, erect the most difficulty for trade. The North protects its own producers and limits market access. Okay, so here's your first choice. Do you support removal of protective instruments in Canada so that the South can trade on a more equal footing? Removal of protection in Canada does not mean that you will suddenly be flooded with organic lettuces. But if we're prepared to establish for the rest of the world, what we in the West are always trying to impose is the equal playing field. And if we can move on debt forgiveness, you offer the rest of the world the opportunity to produce locally, to process locally, instead of monocrop production for export to continue paying off their debt. Okay? And nor does it mean that you don't think you want to be flooded with commodity products from the South, because frankly, there wouldn't be many people here, and there might be some, and we should probably look for the hair shirt they're wearing under their clothes, but there may be some who don't ever want another cup of coffee or another cup of tea or another teaspoon of sugar or another bit of cocoa or another pineapple. Well, good on them. But actually, most of us probably do. So for those of you who supported the removal of the trade restrictions and who have already hopped on the bus, as it were, do you think that we should encourage trade in these kinds of commodities, but in a way in which not multinationals but people own? And that would also encourage the development of local processing, local growing, local processing, local consumption for people much more around the planet. Okay. Now, let's have a look at the loans and the IFIs, the international financial institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, Africa Development Bank. I think it's time we had a really good go at these institutions, and not from the streets, but from the inside. These international financial institutions are only the creatures of nation state members. These delegations are usually led by folks from the Treasury or the Federal Reserve Bank. And I'm tired of the notion that they are not our servants and not accountable to us. We want leadership in our delegations that forces the adoption of basic human rights policies in these IFIs. For example, access to water ought to be non-negotiable. Our delegations ought to be able to go there and say, there shall be no privatisation of water. Full stop. Privatisation in Asia, as studied by ESCAP, Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, have already demonstrated that when you privatise water in cities like Bombay, the immediate benefit is for the middle class who have taps to turn on, but the inflation in water for the people who live in shanties is 1,500%. Okay. There should be no conditions ever around the privatisation of water. Now, it was very nice when the World Bank discovered the poor about 10 years ago. But there's not much evidence that that's informed their practice since. And our delegations have to be forcing these IFIs into something called harmonised overseas development assistance. Now, I'm just going to ask you to park harmonised for a moment. These IFIs have no legal character. It reminds me of the corporation. So that, for example, they cannot be held accountable for human rights abuses, and they are manifold. These are the institutions where, in order to build a hydro dam, where frankly the cost-benefit analysis doesn't add up, they will be engaged in something they call transmigration, which are forced resettlements. I've been in Indonesian villages on Java when people were rounded up by the mayor with the military surrounding the village with guns to grab all of their possessions. When I was there, it was to be shipped to Aceh, Irian Jaya, and Timor. Do you know what's going on here? We're trying to ship sufficient Javanese to the areas where the indigenous peoples are battling for their rights. Timor now has its independence. But there are real major problems around Irian Jaya, where Scott Paper is massively involved, just by the way, and Aceh. And these are gross abuses of human rights. And you don't, they say, have any right of action against international financial institutions because they have no legal character. This is very odd. They're made up of membership of nation states, huh? And they have no legal character. I think it's time we really challenged this as well and asked our countries to be the first around the table saying, this is not good enough. We want accountability around fundamental human rights. They also cannot be held vicariously negligent for the indebtedness that they assist with vast loans and with overseas development assistance that never reaches its destination and that fills up the Swiss bank accounts of highly corrupt, despotic thugs. Do they know that this is going on? Yes, of course they do. They have the capacity to monitor it, and yet on the basis that they cannot interfere in the activities of a sovereign state, they go on paying it. They did this in the Philippines under Marcos. They did this in Indonesia under Suharto. They've done it through a myriad of African countries engaged in militarism and outright corruption. So, are you prepared to work on your government to take a new approach with others and to challenge this nonsense?
You are listening to a Wings archival presentation, economist Marilyn Waring explaining the games nations play around development and trade.
Next, you have to know what some of the very edgy games in town are around what counts as official development assistance. There's something called the DAC Committee, Development Assistance Committee, of the OECD. And they're generally thought of as the arbiters of this. There's a boundary line drawn around so-called development to determine what is what they call DACable, what counts as official development assistance. I'm going to have to keep saying ODA because I'm so used to saying ODA. Every time I get to it, my tongue falls over. So there's a boundary line drawn around this, especially around things military. Now, the best way to explain this is by example. When New Zealand dispatched army medics after the tsunami, that was very simple. That counted as official ODA. When New Zealand dispatched army engineers to Afghanistan and Iraq, the deployment costs had to be met by New Zealand Defence Force, and these were not DACable. But once the engineers were there and began to fix water systems, schools, hospitals, etc., that expenditure was. Okay. But there is, as you can imagine, and particularly with your neighbour, you would understand this, and particularly with this international pressure, right, to push up to 0.7%, an enormous pressure to get there by moving the boundary, not by increasing the total amount. And I am very sorry to say that one of those boundary moves is to be able to count as DACable assistance training a new army, and Canada is in favour of this. So, are you prepared to work very hard to ensure that Canada is not joining the United States of America to move the demarcation line around this issue? Let's have a look at something else that's called TIED aid, T-I-E-D. This is where the donor country insists that in the project or program that they're working in, that is tied to the purchase of products and services and experts from this donor country. Canada was among the world champions of this at one stage. ODA from Canada had to use Canadians, and stuff had to be made in Canada. I think I remember an OECD comparator at one stage that suggested that in this way, Canada managed to spend half of all its ODA inside Canada. Now, there's been some improvement, all right? Especially around the use of experts, where there's some real understanding from CEDA that you probably find the experts in the country that you're working in. But 50% of Canada's ODA is still tied to the products and other services. And the Millennium Development Goals are supposed to use local experts, local expertise, local products to build the capacity of locals, to seek tenders when you need equipment so that the ODA dollars go further. In no other area of government expenditure do people argue in Canada that you shouldn't seek tenders for value for money. But they do in respect of official development assistance. So, will you work to untie the majority of Canada's ODA? New Zealand was the champion of the next problem until 4 years ago. In fact, at one stage, one third of all New Zealand's official development assistance was directed at tertiary scholarships in New Zealand universities. We didn't even have to convert it into a foreign currency. We put them on Air New Zealand planes, we took them to New Zealand universities, and the Treasury just did a transfer to Air New Zealand and to the particular university. Right? Canada's always been good at it too. There are no tracing studies to see that these students ever return home or even play a part in their home countries after these. Frequently, the scholarships are nepotistic. It's really useful to be the daughter of, the son of, the cousin of, the uncle of, to pick up one of those. From the studies that are available, it seems that the very best investments are at a post-secondary level for short-term upskilling courses that are conducted in the region. So, if you support a reconfiguration of CEDA's investments in education from tertiary scholarships to free and basic primary education and to short-term upskilling regional courses, you can go to Barry.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to Marilyn Waring on Caring for People and the Planet, the New Politics of Development. It's a speech the New Zealand author gave in Canada in June 2005. Barry is the Canadian site for one of several rock concerts organized worldwide to benefit people in the developing world. Waring points out that the concerts would only benefit the developing world if they emphasized fair trade with developing countries. Now, here is the last section of part one of Marilyn Waring. We pick her up talking about official development assistance, or ODA, and about how donor countries often assist other countries in ways which protect their own interests rather than the interests of people who live in third world nations.
The last three decades of ODA have seen some really gross outcomes as a result of things called conditionalities. Now, this is when the IMF, you've heard about it in terms of loan, but donor countries in bilateral programs impose conditions, especially around privatisation and especially around market liberalisation. And frankly, this has given conditionality a bad name. There's the Japanese and the whaling game. Then there's the to China game. And then there was the joining the coalition of the willing game. Right? Are you beginning to understand what all these conditionalities are? And the problem is because they've been used, frankly, to truly corrupt ends in those cases, or to Chicago school right-wing economic madness, there's now this problem around conditionality because there is still room for conditionality, should be conditionality of the kind that revenue-paying public in donor countries have a right to expect. There should be, for example, standard undertakings that aid will be withdrawn if there are major rises in military expenditure, if there are gross violations of human rights, if there is no transparent, accountable financial management. Yes, and I would say there should also be withdrawal if there's corruption, but it might be a little difficult for Canada to take that position. I'm not talking about that. Because along with the other members of the G7, Canada has not signed the Convention on Corruption. So, do you think that Canada should sign the Convention on Corruption and then adopt some clean, specific guidelines, such as those that I've enumerated, that are bottom line for ODA bilateral partners? And if you're prepared to put this on your advocacy and lobbying agenda, you can go to Barry. Now, there's also an expectation that this approach for each country around Millennium Development Goals is going to be guided by something called PRSPs, Poverty Reduction Strategy Programs. You know, as I'm working through this, you can see how much the world really wanted you to understand it, can't you? Now, Research by the United Kingdom Aid Agency has pronounced these PRSPs, right? If you're the poor victim of the IMF or the World Bank or one of the regional banks, you have to have them, right? So even the UK specific aid agency, after looking at them, has said they are gender blind, male dominated, and ineffective in responding to local needs and perspectives. Now, when I went through that list of the Millennium Development Goals, you might have heard or noticed that there's a complete absence of a specific sexual or reproductive health Millennium Development Goal. And one of the problems around this is that the whole scenario over the next 10 years from Jeffrey Sachs in respect of the Millennium Development Goals is his assumption that all the available ODA will go toward Millennium Development Goals. Now, if you're not a Millennium Development Goal, what does that mean? That there shouldn't be any investment in sexual and reproductive health? One of the other things, just while I'm on it, this is like in a parenthesis off to the side, that is particularly important around the assumptions and presumptions around the Millennium Development Goals. When you presume that all of ODA will be available for Millennium Development Goals, that means there is none available for tsunami victims. There is none available for famine relief. There is none available for the World Food Programme. Do you see? No crisis, no earthquake, no flood, no famine, no typhoon is factored in to Sachs's equations in terms of the budget for the next 10 years. And of course, there's nothing factored in there for sexual and reproductive health. However, it means that we, other countries, have to really focus and get the amounts up around sexual and reproductive health. So we need to raise New Zealand and Canada's contributions to UNFPA, United Nations Family Planning, right? Or International Planned Parenthood Federation, and many more of these really fantastic programs, okay? And during the next 10 years, we are going to have to watch that every year.
New Zealand economist Marilyn Waring was recorded in Halifax, Nova Scotia by Liz Van Berkel.
Here's a brief update on the program you just heard. Canada did ratify the UN Convention Against Corruption in 2007, and under the Conservative government that lost in 2015, Canada cancelled CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency. The United Nations Millennium Development Goals period expired in 2015, but there's a new version called the Sustainable Development Goals, and one of them leaves a gaping opening for water privatization. But universal access to sexual and reproductive health and rights has finally been included as a goal. Thanks for listening to Wings. I'm Frieda Worden.
Tune in next week for part two of Marilyn Waring in Halifax, Canada.
For more about Wings, check our website, www.wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.